Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Cristobal Cavazos, co-founder of the group Immigrant Solidarity DuPage in Chicago, who explains why immigrant rights activists nationwide are working for the repeal of Arizona's new draconian immigration law. Sarah Sipple of the Center for Health and Gender Equity, who applauds a drop in the global maternal death rate, but says that to achieve future progress, aid must integrate HIV treatment, maternal health, and family planning. And Noam Chomsky, MIT Professor Emeritus of Linguistics, author, political analyst, and activist, who assesses the economic and political failures contributing to the resurgence of American right-wing groups and Tea Party protesters. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir is the only sitting head of state who faces war crime charges from the International Criminal Court. Bashir, who won the country's first multi-party election in 24 years, declared a moral victory on state television. 2 weeks after the vote, Sudan's Election Commission announced Bashir won 68% of the vote. Bashir's two main challengers withdrew prior to the balloting, charging the process had been rigged. Meanwhile, Salva Kiir, the leader of the semi-autonomous South, won almost 93% of the vote to retain his presidency in that region. Bashir's victory was dismissed by Sudanese opposition leader Mubarak al-Fadil of the Umma Party Reform and Renewal faction, who says the election was run under a one-party system with all the foundations of a police state. The Obama administration recognized Sudan's election had many irregularities and inadequacies, but pledged to work with the new government toward the upcoming 2011 plebiscite on whether South Sudan should split off to become a separate state. However, John Prendergast, co-founder of the Anti-Genocide Enough Project, charged the Obama White House is sending yet another signal to Sudanese parties that there will be no repercussions for significant violations of the 2005 North-South peace deal, putting at risk the possibility of successful negotiations in Darfur. The conflict in Sudan has claimed 2 million lives and drove more than 4 million people from their homes. On the eve of Earth Day, Brazil awarded a $10 billion contract to a consortium of 9 different companies, which will allow them to build the world's third largest dam in the pristine Amazon rainforest, claiming it would meet urgent energy needs. Critics charge, however, that the project would displace tens of thousands of indigenous people and further destroy the environment. The dam proposal, known as the Belo Monte Hydroelectric Plant, would generate over 11,000 megawatts of electricity. Construction of the dam is fiercely opposed by indigenous leaders, environmental groups, and Hollywood celebrities, including Avatar director James Cameron. The massive dam project, which has been on the drawing board since the 1970s but didn't materialize due to international opposition, would flood over 500 kilometers of land in the Amazon region on the Xingu River, an area that's home to 14 indigenous tribes. Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva defends the Belo Monte dam project but claims he's concerned for the indigenous people and the environment. Lula sees hydroelectricity as a cheap renewable energy source, and his government plans to build 12 dams in the Amazon to produce power for development. Caiapó tribal leader Rauni Matuktire pledged indigenous men would fight the dam builders with bow and arrows. He told the Guardian newspaper, "I think today the war is about to start once more, and the Indians will be forced to kill the white man so they may leave our lands alone." A grassroots rebellion against conservative Democrats in Congress is brewing in North Carolina. Labor activists are moving quickly to organize a third party called North Carolina First to challenge 3 incumbent Democrats who voted against health care reform: Congressman Larry Kissel, Heath Shuler, and Mike McIntyre. According to the Washington Post, the new party is being bankrolled by the 55,000-member State Employees Association of North Carolina, an affiliate of the Service Employees International Union. In order to start the new party, members have to gather 85,000 signatures by June 1 to qualify for the November ballot. Outgoing SEIU President Andy Stern says he's promoting the third-party initiative to keep Democratic members of Congress accountable for their health care votes. Progressive activists are most upset with Congressman Larry Kissel's vote against health care reform. His district, which spans from Charlotte to Fayetteville, is at the center of the state's struggling textile industry, and Kissel represents one of the highest concentrations of adults in the United States without health insurance. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Indu Anand.
Despite severe criticism, Arizona Governor Jan Brewer signed a state immigration bill into law on April 23rd that critics assert is unconstitutional, as immigration enforcement is under exclusive jurisdiction of the federal government. The law, approved by the Republican-controlled legislature, would make it a crime not to carry documents proving a person's citizenship or legal status. Under the statute, Arizona police now have the authority to detain anyone they suspect may be in the U.S. illegally. As thousands of opponents rallied to protest the law in Phoenix, there was widespread concern across the nation that the new measure would encourage police to subject Hispanics, regardless of their status, to racial profiling and harassment. The push for a new state immigration law followed the murder of a rancher near the Arizona-Mexico border in late March, where the perpetrator is thought to be an undocumented immigrant tied to illegal drug smuggling. According to news reports, Arizona State Senator Russell Pierce, the sponsor of the legislation, is associated with white supremacist groups and foundations supporting eugenics. Lawsuits are expected to be filed against the new law before it's due to take effect this summer. Opponents also say they'll launch a petition drive to repeal the law and are urging an economic boycott of Arizona. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Cristobal Cavazos, co-founder of the group Immigrant Solidarity DuPage in Chicago. He explains why he and other immigrant rights activists will be working for the repeal of the Arizona law and pushing for Congress to begin debate on federal immigration reform legislation.
I think it's just a horrible, a racist piece of legislation, Orwellian to the core. It's a policy that's taking people being in the country without papers and giving the police basically the right to stop anybody if there's a reasonable suspicion. Now, these could be immigrants from Asia, from Latin America, from Africa, and stop them. And if they don't have a license or a green card or a visa, they can be detained. Now, this is potential for a nightmare, as many people don't carry license who are citizens. I think Arizona is really just a terrible situation, another Selma or Birmingham, as I've read about in the 60s. And we will be mobilizing around the country to head out there and to do events in solidarity with the people of Arizona right now.
What's the cause for some of the popularity of this law in Arizona? I know there's been a recent spate of kidnappings, some murders across the border, perpetrators allegedly from Mexico. Is this at all to be expected, given some of the violence in Arizona, or are you kind of perplexed as to where this came from?
No, I think that it's political, that the Republican Party in Arizona is seeking a surge in the polls, and some of the Republican people out there, like John McCain, they're being pressured by even further right elements to support this legislation. Yes, and as you noted, there was a murder maybe a month ago now of a rancher, and that's been very craftily utilized by people in the far right to basically incite this crisis mode and capture the people's consciousness with some very crafty rhetoric and scapegoating of the immigrant population of Arizona. There's certainly reasons that we can point to that are causing this issue in Arizona.
Are you disappointed that the Obama administration has not immediately challenged this in court? Because President Obama has commented that he doesn't feel it upholds constitutional law.
Yeah, it certainly does not. And the guy who's pushing this proposal, this legislation in Arizona, is a state senator by the name of Russell Pierce. Now, he has some very disturbing ties to white supremacist groups, the Minutemen, who are also an anti-immigrant vigilante group. And I think the prospect, if, you know, given the Obama administration's failure to act on an immigration reform, of course, Obama won about 70% of the Latino vote, under the promise that he would have, within his first year in office, an immigration reform bill passed and presented. That year lapsed. We haven't had anything. And I'm going to echo Christopher Dodd, the East Coast senator, who recently noted that the prospect of states, instead of the federal government, but states choosing their own immigration policy is very disturbing. It's a disturbing patchwork to think of Arizona and states like Indiana and Florida all having different immigration policies depending on the strength and vocalness of the right wing in that state. So the Obama administration, they have paid some lip service to, you know, denouncing this bill, but ultimately it's been their failure to act that is causing these right wing elements to really get stirred up and pushing some disturbing state rights proposals and getting these bills passed.
Christabel, do you think that this law in Arizona, which has certainly angered many people across the country, could this be the catalyst for a quicker action from the Obama administration and Congress in bringing to debate immigration reform law?
You know, it very well might be, and that's what we're organizing around. I've been told that in the civil rights movements in the 60s, sheriffs like Bull Connor, who were very similar in proposing bills like the one we're seeing in Arizona right now, fueled a surge in not only African-American community, but their allies. And at this point, people who aren't even interested, who haven't been interested in the past, in immigrant rights are calling us and saying, hey, how do we get involved? People are seeing right through this bill as a racist attack on fundamental human rights of people, and it's disturbing to think the prospects of similar bills going through and just watching our civil rights in this country erode away. So it's an attack on all the citizens of the United States and all people in the United States who are here working and supporting their families. I do think that this is going to have the reverse effect for some of these right-wing elements. People are mobilizing as I speak, really bringing out the issue that this is all happening given the lack of action by Obama and his administration on immigration reform.
That was Cristobal Cavazos, co-founder of the group Immigrant Solidarity DuPage in Chicago. Learn more about the Immigrant Solidarity Network by visiting their website at immigrantsolidarity.org. A study earlier this month in the peer-reviewed medical journal The Lancet indicated a sharp decline in maternal deaths worldwide from 526,000 in 1980 to about 343,000 in 2008. The study by researchers at the University of Washington and the University of Queensland in Brisbane, Australia, was paid for by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. The report cited a number of reasons for the improvement: lower pregnancy rates in some countries, higher income, which improves nutrition and access to health care, improved levels of education for women, and the increasing availability of skilled attendants, people with some medical training, to assist women during labor. Advances in countries with large populations like India and China helped drive down the overall death rate, although India joined Nigeria, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Ethiopia, and the Democratic Republic of Congo in accounting for half of all maternal deaths in 2008. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Sarah Sipple, president of the Center for Health and Gender Equity, an organization that works to ensure U.S. foreign policies and programs promote women's and girls' sexual and reproductive health within a human rights framework. In a letter to the New York Times about the maternal death study, Sipple applauded the drop in deaths, but says women with HIV/AIDS make up a disproportionate number who die in pregnancy and childbirth. To further reduce the death rate, she says governments and private aid organizations must stop compartmentalizing the different aspects of women's lives.
The report is very good news, the decline in maternal mortality, given that for years we as advocates of women's health rights have been citing 500,000 women dying every year from preventable causes. We welcome this. This is great news that it's dropped down below 350,000. However, this is obviously not mission accomplished. We still have hundreds of thousands of women dying every year from pregnancy-related causes, and we know how to reduce those numbers. That's the good news in this report, is we know what's working, and so we can put more money into it. We can be more effective with our funding.
The report says that some of the remaining maternal deaths are related to HIV and AIDS. In your letter to the Times, you wrote that HIV, maternal health, and family planning are financed, programmed, and evaluated separately, and how that's a problem. What do you think should change, and what difference would it make if it were done differently?
It was very distressing about the HIV impact on maternal deaths. And in fact, The Lancet even stated in its summary findings that in the absence of HIV, there would have been 281,500 maternal deaths in 2008 instead of 342,000. So this needs to be looked at carefully. In sub-Saharan Africa, where we see 60% of those infected with HIV are women, that's the region where we saw Southern Africa, Eastern Africa, and increase in maternal deaths due to HIV-related, and that comes out to about 60,000 deaths in 2008, which is very distressing. But it highlights this need for really looking at these health interventions as connected when they're seen through the lens of women, so that HIV and maternal health interventions on the ground really need to be linked and connected, and that means connecting it to family planning as well, because we know that prevents unintended pregnancies, which can improve a woman's health. So the natural result of siloed funding is siloed programs. In silos, I mean family planning, maternal health, and HIV/AIDS, all these areas of global health being funded separately within U.S. foreign policy. However, when we look at women's lives, our health issues are not siloed. A pregnant woman might need HIV treatment. A woman who's pregnant or has children wants to avoid pregnancy. So these are decisions, health issues that are very much integrated into women's lives. The solution to this, though, it would be the integrated programming on the ground, so that when you have these funding streams and the policies attached to them in Washington, D.C., that we have to make sure that when that funding goes to the ground, that it almost goes through this funnel, so that on the ground, programs truly reflect the holistic health needs and lives of women, men, and young people.
Sarah Sipple, I know that under President George W. Bush, there were some serious problems with women's health issues and funding and so on. Under the Obama administration, what do you see as the biggest obstacles to taking down the silos and improving that care and connecting those issues?
Well, I'll start with the positive in terms of the Obama administration's announcement last year of the Global Health Initiative, which is a philosophy, an approach to global health that is going to link these issues, HIV, family planning, maternal health, along with other major global health issues. However, there are some issues that still remain that we have to address. For example, unsafe abortions is a huge factor in maternal deaths. We have some 70,000 women dying each year from unsafe abortion. According to U.S. law, no U.S. federal funding can pay for abortions overseas, except for in the cases of rape, incest, and to save the life of the mother where it's legal. And U.S. funding is not going to pay for safe abortion where it is acceptable within U.S. law as well as the law of the countries. So, for example, in Ethiopia, where abortion is legal in the cases of rape and incest. However, U.S. funding is not being permitted to pay for those legal abortions, which would be legal according to U.S. law as well. What we need with the Obama administration is to put forward policy guidance that would facilitate the use of these fundings on the ground to pay for these legal procedures, which are life-saving procedures.
That was Sarah Sipple, president of the Washington, D.C.-based Center for Health and Gender Equity. Contact the center at area code 202-393-3930 or visit their website at genderhealth.org. Since the election of Barack Obama, America's first black president, in November 2008, the nation has witnessed the birth of the self-described Tea Party protest movement, demonstrating their opposition to big government, deficit spending, and tax increases. The rise of conservative activist groups coincides with a dramatic upsurge in membership in right-wing patriot organizations and associated militia groups. The federal government arrest of 9 members of the Houthari militia, a self-described Christian group preparing for attacks against local police to spark a right-wing revolution, is an echo of the armed militia movement of the 1990s, which created the climate of fear in which Timothy McVeigh bombed the Oklahoma City Federal Building on April 19, 1995. Noam Chomsky, professor emeritus at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in Linguistics and Philosophy, is one of the world's most widely read progressive dissident intellectuals. In recent talks and writings, Chomsky has said the level of anger and fear in America today is unlike anything he's seen during his lifetime. But he cautions progressive activists not to make the mistake of ridiculing or dismissing the grievances and expressions of anger on the right. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Professor Chomsky about the economic and political failures that he believes have contributed to the resurgence of American right-wing groups and Tea Party protesters.
Tea Party activists are estimated at under 20% of the population. On the other hand, close to half the population says that the Tea Party movement pretty much expresses their attitudes and beliefs. So that's quite a broad swath of the population. And if it hasn't really been analyzed carefully, but chances are it's probably not unlike the listeners to, say, Rush Limbaugh, who have been studied. Of them, close to half have incomes of less than $50,000 a year. That's less than the median. Those are people who really do have grievances. For the past 30 years, the majority of Americans have seen their incomes pretty much stagnate. Their benefits have declined. The quality of life has declined as measured by standard social indicators. Their distrust and extreme dislike of institutions, government, corporations, everybody, has increased very sharply, and they have seen a tremendous wealth accumulated, but in very few pockets. And, of course, all this came to a head with the bailout of the financial institutions that essentially created the crisis and are responsible for the extremely high unemployment and are generating the greatest profits in their history. Well, we can go on, but all of those are legitimate grievances. I mean, they may be expressed in ugly and destructive and even self-destructive ways, but that's not to deny that the grievances are real. Now, these people rightly want some answers. Why is this happening to me? You know, I'm hardworking. I do all the right things I've been taught to do. I'm a God-fearing Christian. I take care of my family or try to. What's happening to me? I'm a white male. Why is this happening to me? Well, it's fair for them to ask for answers. They're not getting them from, say, liberal Democrats who are not going to say, yeah, this is happening to you because back in the late 70s, we agreed with the business classes that we should move towards financialization of the economy, sharply increasing the role of financial institutions in the economy as a corollary to that, hollowing out domestic production so your fairly decent jobs will go off to Mexico or China or wherever it may be next. They're not going to hear that. They're not getting answers from what I think are the correct answers from the left critics are being voiced, but in a atomized fashion, which doesn't even reach a fraction of the population. So they are getting a voice from talk radio, an answer from talk radio. It may be a crazy answer, but at least it's an answer. It's the fault of the liberal Democrats who are on the banks and are giving everything away to illegal immigrants and don't care about you people between the coasts and so on and so forth. Well, okay, it's kind of an answer. It doesn't have anything to do with reality, but it's an answer. It's internally coherent. And instead of ridiculing, you know, the often ridiculous claims that they come out with and self-destructive ones, we should be asking ourselves, well, why aren't we organizing them?
Professor Chomsky, in recent talks and writings, you said that the resurgence of the extreme right in this country is unlike anything you've ever seen. Is the economic uncertainty and the dysfunction you described of our political system a cause for concern about the rise of a unique brand of American neo-fascism?
It's a cause for concern. I mean, in the latest polls, about 20% of the population think it's their government, you know, that the government regards them as a concern. About half the population thinks that every member of Congress should be thrown out, including their own representative. And it goes on like that. I mean, this is a degree of disillusion and dislike of governmental authority that's quite extreme and reminiscent of other times. I mean, for example, you take late Weimar Germany, 1920s, early 30s, one of the striking things at that period was the collapse of the traditional political parties, the liberal and conservative parties, more or less centrist parties, who had dominated Germany ever since the Second Reich was established. Well, they just became discredited. People couldn't stand their wrangling, the fact that they weren't doing anything for the population. They were either serving their own interests or serving other powerful interests. You know, there was a great wave of disillusionment with established power. And a charismatic figure came along who said, well, I've got the answer. You know, it's the Bolsheviks and the Jews, and I'm going to bring back the grandeur of Germany, and so on and so forth. And, well, we know what happened.
That was Noam Chomsky, MIT Professor Emeritus of Linguistics, author, political analyst, and activist. Listen to the full 30-minute interview with Professor Chomsky at btlonline.org. Read more about Professor Chomsky's books, papers, and articles online at chomsky.info and zmag.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced in association with WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Indu Anon, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.